Risco. Dinkins and the others came upon a large cottonwood tree standing just outside the town. Hanging from a limb was a corpse. His hands were tied behind his back, and his head and neck were misshapen from the effect of the hanging. The corpse was twisting slowly at the end of the rope.
Son of a bitch! What the hell is this? I didn't think there was any law in Risco.
Whoever hanged the man didn't bother to put a hood over his face, leaving the grotesque visage of violent death for all to see. The man's skin was black, though it didn't appear that he had been a black man in life. His cheeks were puffed, his mouth was open, and flies were crawling in and out of it. The worst part about him was his eyes. They were bulging nearly out of their sockets.
He sure is an ugly son of a bitch, ain't he?
Does anyone know who he is?
I don't know him, but him being all black and puffed like he is, I don't think I'd recognize him even if I did know him.
Got a sign pinned to his pant leg there.
Frank rode up to the hanging corpse. Then, standing in the stirrups, he reached up to pull off the sign.
What does it say?
This is the corpse of Frank Marlowe. Not assume that because we have no law in this town means we have no law. Mr. Marlowe carved up and killed one of our soiled doves, and for that he has paid the extreme penalty.
Better pin the sign back on him.
Frank did. Then the four men rode on into Risco, stopping in front of the saloon. Inside, they got two bottles of blended whiskey, then found a table. When the whores they had stayed with before saw him, they came over to the table to join him. The dissipation of years on the line told in all four of them. There was not a one who was in the least attractive, and none of them could have been able to make a living in their profession anywhere else but Risco. The irony was that they were making more money than they had ever made before in their lives, but the money did them little good, since it cost so much to live in Risco.
We need to decide where we're going to go from here.
I hope you ain't got no more ideas about holding up another train, because we sure didn't get much from the last one.
Yeah, this was about as bad as the bank in Gothic was.
You can't win them all. We ain't done all that bad. We got $6,000 from the Bank of Crystal and another $5,000 from the coach holdup.
So what do you have in mind next?
I figure we won't do anything for a while. We got some money. We'll just stay here until something else comes up.
Sapinero. It was nearly 10 o'clock and the night creatures were calling to each other as Smoke stood looking toward Sapinero. The clouds passed over the moon and moved away, bathing in silver the little town that rose up like a ghost before him. The main street was fronted on both sides by buildings, more than half of which were dark. The biggest and most brightly lit building was the saloon at the far end of town. Between Delta and Sapinero, he had found 10 of the dead or alive Dodgers, which were posting a $5,000 reward on his head. He had destroyed every one of them, but he wondered if there were any reward posters in this town. Well, if there were, he would just have to deal with them. Smoke passed by a coach sitting in front of the stage depot. The coach was dark and there was no team attached, but obviously it had been moved into position to be able to leave town at first light. He rode on through the town, the only one out on the street at that hour. He stopped in front of the saloon, then wrapped the reins around the hitching rail before stepping up onto the porch. Two men came through the front door, and the lantern light that spilled out from the interior, Smoke studied them. He had no idea what Bill Dinkins looked like, and he only knew Wes Harley by description. But he knew what Travis and Frank Slater looked like because he had studied their pictures. He studied the two men as they exited the saloon, their private conversation so intense they took no notice of Smoke. He didn't know who they were, but he knew who they weren't. They were not the Slater brothers. Once his eyes had adjusted inside, Smoke stepped up to the bar. He didn't call for the bartender, but waited quietly until he saw him. When the barman noticed him, he was slightly startled.
Damn, mister, I didn't see you come in. You been standing there long?
Not too long.
What can I get you?
A beer, some food, if it's not too late.
It ain't too late if you ain't none too particular. We got some boiled ham and boiled taters.
That'll be fine. I'll be right over there.
As he was eating his late supper, Smoke noticed a card game going on in a small alcove off the back of the saloon. The players were engaged in an animated conversation, and he heard one of them say the name Dinkins. Smoke lingered over his supper until one of the four players left the game. Then he walked to the table.
If you need a fourth player, I'd be willing to join you. But if this is a private game, I have no wish to intrude.
There's an empty chair right there. You're welcome to join us.
Thank you.
Wait a minute. Before you sit, I need to know if you are a saddle tramp or a man of means.
Why do you ask?
The reason I ask is because this isn't a penny-ante game. I wouldn't want you to get in here and suddenly realize you was in over your head.
Jim is right. We don't want to take you in, mister, without you knowing what you are letting yourself in for. This is what you might call a high-stakes game. Here's the thing. You see, you have to buy a minimum of $50 worth of chips just to get into this game. If you can do that, you're more than welcome at our table.
Well, thank you. I'll take 100.
Smoke took 5 gold double eagles from his pocket and put them on the table in front of him.
Take care, Molly. Ollie's our banker. I'm Al Frakes. I publish the newspaper here. The banker is Ollie Lynch. Ollie is a messenger for Wells Fargo. And the gentleman who challenged you is Jim Sadler. He owns the Leather Goods and Saddle Shop, which I think is most appropriate for someone with the name Sadler.
Who might you be?
The name is Jensen. Kirby Jensen. But most folks just call me Smoke.
You are Smoke Jensen?
Yes.
It is an honor to meet you, Mr. Jensen. I hope you don't hold it against me that I asked if you had the means to play in this game.
Not at all. If I didn't have enough money to play, it would have been a friendly gesture.
Sadler was the dealer, and on the first hand, Smoke drew 2 pair, which was enough to keep him in the game. He wasn't able to convert it into a full house, though, and he lost to Frakes, who had drawn 3 tens. Over the next half hour, Smoke won some and lost some, so that he stood about $10 ahead in the game. The conversation flowed easily, mostly about the game, but often coming back to an article that had been published in Al Frakes' newspaper about the train robbery.
What article is that?
Well now, I just happen to have a copy of that newspaper with me. It is, in my humble opinion, the best newspaper published between Denver and San Francisco.
Your opinion isn't all that humble when you figure that you're the publisher.
Frakes gave Smoke the newspaper, then pointed out the article that appeared on the front page.
Bold train robbery near Sepinero. Bill Dinkins' gang, the culprits. It was lacking 5 minutes of 11 in the evening when one of the outlaws, believed to be Travis Slater, climbed over the tender and ordered engineer Ernest Gibson to slow the train. Complying with the request, the train was slowed, then diverted to a sidetrack where it was ultimately brought to a halt. Engineer Gibson jumped down from the engine cab and attempted to escape, but was shot down and killed by Travis Slater. The robbers then dynamited the express car and ordered the messenger, Cy the Express Man, to open the safe, from which the robbers took $136. They then proceeded to pass through the train, ordering the passengers to give it up, but were able to gather less than $200 in that operation, making their entire haul for the robbery just over $300. A mounted posse went in pursuit of the gang by the next morning, but they lost the trail and returned empty-handed.
I'll bet they were some mad when they found out the messenger had hidden the money shipment.
Well, they ain't likely to find out. Not where they are now. There's no newspapers.
Why do you say that? Do you know where they are?
And more than likely, they're in Risco.
Risco?
It's a little town on Cabela Creek, about halfway between Hare and Powderhorn.
Never heard of it.
It's not on any map, and that's by design. They don't want anybody to know they're there.
Why, that beats all I've ever heard. Why would a town not want anybody to know of its existence?
It's what some might call a robber's roost. Men who are running from the law go there, knowing there's little chance anyone from the law will trace them there.
You know the town, Mr. Jensen?
Smoke had visited the town once when he was on the Dodge going by the name of Buck West.
Yes, I know the town.
How is it that you know the town, Ollie?
I wasn't always an agent for Wells Fargo. At one time in my life, I was a different kind of agent.
My God, you mean you were a road agent?
I was 19. and I fell in with the wrong crowd. I served 2 years, and I've been straight ever since.
Does Wells Fargo know about this?
They know. That's why they let me handle their money, just as you men are doing in this card game.
I would like to ask you something, Ollie. Now, when you say you fell in with the wrong crowd, would that be Bill Dinkins?
I don't have anything to do with Dinkins anymore.
What? Ollie, are you telling me that you were not only a road agent, but that you actually rode with Bill Dinkins?
If you gentlemen would rather I not play cards with you anymore, I will understand. I don't want to cause any trouble.
Oh, we weren't saying that, Ollie. Well, we aren't saying that at all, are we, Jim?
No, I didn't mean to imply anything like that.
Mr. Lynch, I don't mean to be pushy or anything, but I have a personal interest in locating Bill Dinkins and the men who are riding with him.
I know you do, Mr. Jensen. I doubt there is anyone in Colorado who doesn't know that Dinkins shot your wife. It's been in all the papers. How is she, by the way?
She's had a hard time of it, but she's doing well now. Well,
I figured she must be, or you wouldn't be hunting for him. You'd be back home with your wife.
Yeah, you think he might be in Risco, do you?
Well, I can't be for sure because I haven't seen him in over 5 years, but when I was riding with him, we spent quite a bit of time there.
May I ask what was the attraction of such a place?
Well, think about it, Al. What is the good of holding up a stagecoach or robbing a bank if you can't spend your money? And if you're a wanted man, you can't spend it in a town like a normal person would. You can't even go into a regular town without fear of being recognized. So everyone winds up in Risco at one time or another. Risco has restaurants, hotels, drug stores, general stores, saloons, gambling halls, and whorehouses. But in short, everything a man might need. The only thing is, everything costs about 3 or 4 times more than it does anywhere else.
Mr. Lynch, I thank you kindly for the information. I just don't know why I hadn't thought of Risco myself.
You'll be going there, will you, Mr. Jensen?
Yes.
Well, maybe you're going after Bill Dinkins, and I know why you are. But he ain't the one you gotta worry about. The one you gotta worry about is Wes Harley. I reckon you heard of him.
Yes, I've heard of him. Cole Parnell told me about him before he was hanged. Parnell said he was Dinkins' brother.
Yes, sir, he is. They got the same ma, but the pa's different.
I'm not looking for Harley. He is the one who shot Sally.
Well, that don't matter none. Like as not, he knows you're after them, so he'll be looking for you now. And here's the thing. He's like Dinkins in that he would just as soon kill you as look at you. What makes him different from Dinkins is that he's good at it.
Thanks for the warning.
He's not going to stop you from looking for him, though, is he?
Not for a minute.
In the 3 days since the train robbery, Dinkins and his men had been living lavishly on the money they had taken from the bank in Crystal and from the stagecoach. With the increased prices of everything in town, they were paying $1 for a glass of beer and $25 for a bottle of whiskey. The women were charging them $50, but as long as the men had the money, they spent it, unaware that the high prices had been fixed for them alone. They had gotten very little money from the train robbery, and the money they had taken from the bank and the stagecoach was diminishing rapidly as they spent it foolishly and gambled unwisely. As they saw the money going, their attitude toward the citizens of Risco became more and more belligerent. Thus it was that James Webb had a talk with Bill Dinkins. Risco had neither mayor nor sheriff, but even a city without law had to have some sort of leader, and James Webb had assumed that role. A graduate of Washington University in St. Louis, Webb had studied for the law and had been a circuit judge in Missouri when he was caught taking bribe money to affect the outcome of a major case. The date for the trial was set, and Webb, because he was an important and influential figure, was given bail. There was no doubt in his mind that he would be sent to prison where he'd face many of the hardened criminals he'd sent there. He was convinced that he wouldn't live a year in prison, so he jumped bail. Abandoning his wife and 2 children, he headed west, winding up in the lawless town of Risco.
What do you want to talk about?
You and the men with you. You, Harley, and the Slater brothers are, well, to put it as delicately as I can, upsetting the equilibrium of our little town.
I tell you the truth, Webb, I don't have an idea in hell what you just said.
All right, let me reword it. Our little community is unique. We have neither law nor governing structure, and we ask no questions about anyone's past. But just because we have no law does not mean you can behave any way you want while you are staying with us. No doubt you noticed the corpse of the recently deceased Frank Marlowe when you rode into town.
Yeah, it was kind of hard to miss.
That's good. Mr. Marlowe, you see, is an object lesson. We left him there as a reminder to others that there is a limit to our tolerance. He carved up and killed one of our whores. The rest of the town took umbrage with that.
Yeah, well, what are you talking to me for? We ain't done nothing like that.
You have been, however, rather brutal with the ladies. And you have been belligerent to the ones who serve us here. The bartenders, the cooks, the clerks in our stores.
They've been charging us too much.
I'm sure you can understand there must be some added cost to living here and enjoying the freedom that we enjoy.
So what you're saying is you want us to be nicer to the hired help.
I'm just giving you a few words of advice. You know, there are some people who don't want you here at all. You have a string of murders behind you that might attract enough lawmen here that we won't be able to discourage them.
Wait a minute. Are you telling me that among the horse thieves, cattle rustlers, bank coach, and train robbers here, there ain't none of them ever killed anyone?
I am sure that quite a few of our citizens have killed. But generally, they have killed because they were forced to. With you and your men, it is almost as if you have killed for no other reason than the pleasure it gives you.
Is that what you think?
It is, indeed. Oh, and one final thing, Mr. Dinkins. As a result of the string of killings you and your men have left behind, the reward money being offered now is $1,500 for you, dead or alive. It is $1,000 for Mr. Harley, dead or alive, and $500 each for Frank and Travis Slater. Now that makes the four of you worth a total of $3,500. And I must warn you, that sum is enough to tempt some of our citizens.
What you're saying is we should leave town. That is what you're saying, ain't it?
Let us just say I am making a strong suggestion to that effect.
Smoke removed his U.S. Deputy Marshal's badge and put it in his saddlebag before he rode into town. It had been a long time since he was last in Risco, but as he rode down Outlaw Way, the main street of a little town, the year seemed to fall away. The town, inbred and festering, serviced by neither railroad nor stagecoach, had not changed. The purpose for which it existed meant it was better off remaining unheralded, unnoticed, and for the most part, unknown. Looping Seven's reins around the hitching post in front of the saloon, Smoke loosened the pistol in his holster, then pushed through the swinging doors to step inside. To his amazement, the man tending bar was the same one who had been tending bar when he was there last. He stepped up to the bar, and when the bartender moved toward him, Smoke greeted him with a smile.
Hello, Dixon. Are you still watering the whiskey?
Buck West. I haven't seen you in so long, I thought you'd gone straight. Actually, I hoped you'd gone straight.
Well, so far I've managed to stay out of trouble.
Dixon drew a beer without being asked, then put it in front of Smoke.
Well, if you ain't wanted, what are you doing here? Risco ain't the kind of place someone visits for pleasure.
Maybe it's for old time's sake. You know, to see you and a few other old friends.
Well, I doubt there's anyone here now that was here when you were here, except for me. Most of the merchants make a killing here, sell out, and move on. And most of our residents, well, to tell you the truth, Buck, they don't generally live that long. They wind up hung or shot. I'm surprised to see that you're still alive.
Sometimes I'm surprised myself.
Well, I'll ask you again, what are you doing here?
I'm looking for some people, and I was sort of hoping I might find them here.
Have you turned bounty hunter, West? Are you looking to cash in on the reward for someone? because I can't help you, you know that. If I turned someone over to a bounty hunter, my life wouldn't be worth a wooden nickel.
I'm not a bounty hunter, Dixon. This is personal.
You see that man sitting over there reading?
Smoke had seen him when he first came into the saloon. In fact, he had checked everyone out when he first came in, not only to see if he might recognize the Slater brothers or Harley, but to make certain there was nobody who might recognize him.
Yeah, I saw him when I came in.
His name is Webb. He's a judge.
A judge? Here?
Yeah, well, I didn't say he was an honest judge. But he sort of runs things here, or at least keeps things even. Maybe you seen the corpse hanging from the tree when you come into town?
I did see it. Smelled it, too.
Yeah, well, some of the people are already complaining about the smell. But anyway, Judge Webb is the one that held the trial and sentenced him to hang. So if you got something personal against someone here, I suggest you talk to the judge.
All right, I will. Thanks. Oh, what does the judge drink?
Whiskey. Blended.
Pour me a shot.
Carrying his beer and a shot of whiskey, Smoke walked over to Webb's table.
May I join you for a few minutes, Your Honor?
Please, do not call me Your Honor. There is no longer anything about me that is honorable.
All right.
Smoke put the glass of whiskey in front of Webb, and with a nod of thanks, Webb picked it up and tossed it down.
Now, sir, what can I do for you? But I must tell you before we begin to talk that as I am not a conventional outlaw, I do not steal or rob. My only source of income is the money I get by providing legal advice.
I'm not asking for legal advice, per se, but I'm perfectly willing to pay you for engaging in this conversation.
Per se? My, one does not often hear language like that here. It is refreshing. Are you an educated man, sir?
My wife is a school teacher. She's done what she could to educate me.
You are also married. I must say you are an unusual specimen for this settlement. What can I do for you, Mr.?
When I was in town before, folks knew me as Buck West. That's how Mr. Dixon addressed me a few moments ago. I'm going to tell you my real name, Judge. And in doing so, I am, in a manner of speaking, putting my life in your hands.
Are you a lawman?
Not by profession, though from time to time I've been deputized. My name is Smoke Jensen.
So, you are the famous Smoke Jensen?
Yes, and I'm here to...
You don't have to tell me why you are here, Mr. Jensen. I know why you are here.
You do?
We may be isolated, but from time to time, newspapers find their way here. I am aware that your wife was shot, either by Dinkins or one of the men with him. I expect you are after them.
Yes, but not for any reward. My quest is a personal vendetta.
And what do you want from me, Mr. Jensen? Do you want some legal action, similar to that which was dispensed to Frank Marlowe?
Frank Marlowe?
The gentleman hanging from the cottonwood tree.
Not exactly.
I see. You want to dispense your own justice, do you?
Yes. And what I want from you, Judge, is your permission. This is your town. And as long as I'm in your town, I'm willing to play by your rules.
Interesting. All right. You have my permission. You do know, do you not, that Wes Harley is one of the men who is associated with Bill Dinkins?
I've heard that. But he had no hand in shooting my wife.
That doesn't matter. I expect that you are not going to be able to get to Dinkins without first going through Wes Harley. And I think you would find him to be quite a formidable adversary.
I've never seen him, but I've heard him described. Is he in this room now?
He is not. I believe he is visiting in one of the cribs out back.
Thank you. I guess that means I'm going to have to take care of him first.
Word had spread, not just through the saloon, but all through town. Someone had challenged Wes Harley to a gunfight in the street. The name of the man who had challenged him, Dixon informed the others, was Buck West, a long-ago resident of Risco. Outlaw Way was lined on both sides with spectators, as every resident of Risco had turned out to watch the gunfight. Smoke was standing in front of the saloon. He felt a little exposed. No doubt there were people in the crowd who had one reason or another to want him dead. But there was an intense interest running through the crowd. The excitement of seeing a gunfight take place between two men who had far-reaching reputations as to their skills with a pistol.
Well, here comes Harley!
Someone had told Smoke that Wes Harley looked like a walking skeleton. And he thought that description was pretty apt. Harley was a gangly-looking man, that was true. But it wasn't the fact that he was skinny as much as that he was hairless and his head really did look like a skull. He walked into the middle of the street in front of the general store. He stood, not facing Smoke, but with his side to him, presenting much less of a target that way.
Before I kill you, mister, you want to tell me who you are?
The name is Jensen. Smoke Jensen.
Folks, let me have your attention.
Judge Webb stepped into the street between Smoke and Harley. He held his arms up in the air.
Your attention, please. Mr. Jensen came to me a little while ago. He has assured me he is not here in pursuit of bounty, nor does he want to arrest anyone. Oddly enough, his fight is not with Harley, but with Dinkins and Frank and Travis Slater, they being the men who shot his wife. But I pointed out that I did not think he could get to them without going through Mr. Harley, thus bringing about the confrontation we are all about to witness. Now, I'm going to say now that if anyone in the crowd violates the integrity of this duel, I will see to it that you join Mr. Marlowe in hanging from the tree.
So, you are the famous Mr. Smoke Jensen. Yes, sir. Killing you is going to be quite a feather in my cap.
Smoke said nothing.
You have nothing to say to me, Mr. Jensen?
I'm not here to have a conversation with you, Harley. I'm here to kill you.
Because of the way Harley was standing, presenting his left side to Smoke, his gun hand was hidden. Smoke couldn't be sure when Harley started to draw. When he saw Harley twist around toward him, he realized Harley had already pulled his gun, getting it out stealthily as they were talking. Harley fired even as Smoke was drawn, but the bullet missed Smoke. Smoke returned fire, and he didn't miss. Smoke held the smoking pistol in his hand for a moment longer. When he was convinced Wes Harley was dead, he holstered his pistol. Several of the crowd gathered around Harley, looking down at him with morbid curiosity, thus leaving Smoke standing alone several feet away.
Mr. Jensen?
Yes.
You don't remember me, Mr. Jensen, but my name is Wanda. I met you once many years ago when you were playing cards in a saloon where I was working.
Ah, well, it's nice to see you again, Wanda.
Well, thank you, but I'm not trying to call back old memories or anything. I understand you're looking for Dinkins and his man.
Yes, I am. Do you know where they are?
They rode out of town about 15 minutes ago, as soon as they heard your name.
It wasn't hard to pick up the trail of three horses moving quickly. Smoke was too far back, and they were moving too fast for him to catch a glimpse of them, but he didn't need to see them to know where they were going. The trail was leading into a canyon, Black Canyon. One of the steepest, darkest, and most rugged of all canyons, Black Canyon was formed by the Gunnison River as it flowed through hard ancient rocks at the western edge of the Rocky Mountains on its way to joining the Colorado River at Grand Junction. Smoke had been there before. He knew the canyon walls, composed of volcanic schist, were predominantly black in color. And because the gorge reached a depth of over 2,000 feet, and because it was no more than 1,500 feet across, the wall seldom received any direct sunlight. For that reason, it was called Black Canyon. Smoke was a little leery as he approached the canyon. He knew it would be an ideal place for the outlaws to set up an ambush. He stopped for a moment and listened hard, trying to hear anything from ahead. The whicker of a horse, a voice, even the scratch of iron-shod hooves on stone. If there had been any sound, it should have carried to him quite easily, as the canyon walls had the effect of a megaphone. But listen though he did, he could hear nothing.
What do you think, Seven? Yip going in there?
The horse was exceptionally intelligent, with an innate awareness of things. Smoke knew that Seven sensed danger, but he also knew the horse wouldn't falter. Smoke pulled his rifle from the saddle sheath and started into the canyon. He hadn't ridden more than 100 yards into the canyon before Seven stopped.
I know, boy. I feel it too.
Smoke neither heard nor saw anything. But in that sixth sense developed by men who constantly live on the edge of danger, he felt something. Suddenly, a bullet whizzed by not 6 inches in front of his face. With his rifle in his hand, Smoke slid down quickly.
Go back, Seven.
As the horse whirled around and galloped out of the canyon, Smoke ran toward a nearby line of large rocks, diving for cover just as another shot rang out. Smoke rolled to his left and, coming out of the roll, had the rifle to his shoulder. He saw the puff of smoke from the outlaw's rifle, then saw the outlaw raise up slightly to have a look. He only stayed up for a second, but that was all Smoke needed. A second later, the outlaw tumbled down the wall on the other side of the canyon.
Frank! Frank! Dinkins, he got my brother! He got Frank!
Yeah? Well, he should have kept his head down.
We shouldn't have come into this canyon. We ain't got no way out.
Travis is right, Dinkins. Your boys are in trouble. You have no way out of here without coming through me.
Seems to me you're the one in trouble. We got you trapped down here.
Uh-uh. I got my water and food with me. I'll just bet you fellas left yours with your horses.
He's right, Dinkins. We ain't got no water or nothing up here.
Shut up, Travis. Don't be such a yellow belly. See if you can get a look at where he's at.
I ain't moving from here, and I ain't sticking my head up at him. I seen what happened to Frank. Jensen killed my brother.
Dinkins began firing wild and unaimed shots, which gave Smoke a chance to improve his own position without fear of being hit. Crouching over, he ran behind the line of rocks, then darted across the little open gap so he was on the same side of the trail as the outlaws.
Did you get him?
From the sound of Travis's voice, Smoke knew he was no more than 50 or 60 yards away. He began looking around for a way up to him.
I don't think so.
Clearly, Dinkins was farther back in the canyon.
You must have got him. I don't see him or hear him moving around down there. I think you got him.
Smoke smiled at their confusion.
Shoot again.
You shoot. I'll keep an eye open, and if he returns your fire, I'll have him.
I ain't got nothing to shoot at. He's like a ghost or something.
Take a look, Travis. See if you can see him.
I ain't moving.
Shoot at him, you son of a bitch, or I'll shoot you.
Smoke saw Travis lift his head up. Unlike the others who had rifles, Travis was armed only with a pistol. He began shooting wild, unaimed shots at the rocks on the other side of the canyon where Smoke had been earlier.
Did you see him?
No!
Smoke managed to climb up a fissure until he was just a few feet away. He waited until the hammer on Travis's gun fell on an empty chamber.
All right, I shot at him. Now it's your turn to shoot at him. I'm out of bullets. I have to reload.
You dumb bastard. You didn't do nothing but waste your bullets.
Smoke stepped out in front of Travis.
No!
Travis raised his pistol and pointed it at Smoke, snapping the trigger even though his gun was empty. Smoke took him down with a vertical butt stroke of his rifle.
Travis! Travis, what's going on over there? What were you yelling about?
Smoke remained quiet.
Travis, what is it? Answer me!
He can't answer you, Dinkins!
What? What are you talking about? Where are you? Where's Travis?
Smoke looked down at Travis, and he could tell by the twist in his neck and his open but sightless eyes, still fixed in his last instant of terror, that Travis was dead.
Where is Travis?
He's dead! He's dead! Frank is dead! And Wes Harley is dead! Now there's only you!
I give up! Don't shoot! I'm coming down! I give up! You hear me?
I hear you! Come on out here with your hands high!
Dinkins came walking down a path that led up to a higher ridge. His hands were up, as Smoke had ordered, but he was holding a rifle in his right hand. Smoke noticed that though Dinkins was holding the rifle over his head, his hand was wrapped around the narrow part of the stock in the receiver. His finger was inside the trigger guard and actually on the trigger itself. Smoke also noticed that the hammer was cocked.
Throw down the rifle!
Oh! No fooling the great Smoke Jensen, is there? You seen the rifle cocked. Well, you can't blame me for trying, can you?
Throw it down!
Dinkins pulled the trigger, but as it was over his head and aimed to one side, it represented no danger to Smoke.
That was just to keep it from going off when it hits the ground. Wouldn't want that to happen now, would we? Might have gone off on me, or you.
Dinkins tossed the rifle aside.
Tell me, Jensen, do you know any good lawyers? Whoever it is, I hope it ain't the same one that defended Parnell. Poor old Parnell got himself hung, but I'm sure you know that.
All the time Dinkins was talking to Smoke, he was going down the path. An easy walk sometimes. Other times, when the path made a steep drop or in some other way made its transit difficult, Dinkins put one or two hands on a rock to help him negotiate the obstacle. When Dinkins was no more than 30 feet from Smoke, the path stepped down about 3 feet. It was too far to step directly down, but a rock outcropping provided Dinkins with some leverage when he put his hand on it. He stepped down with some difficulty. Smoke had been watching him descend, almost lulled into the slow, laborious operation, when all of a sudden a pistol appeared in Dinkins' hand. Dinkins wasn't wearing a holster. That was one of the first things Smoke had checked. So where the hell did the pistol come from? That wasn't a thought Smoke dwelled on for more than a split second, though, for a split second is all the time he had to respond. He fired, his bullet hitting Dinkins in the middle of his chest. Dinkins fell head first down the drop, his head hitting the stone ground below. He flipped over on his back, then stared up through open but sightless eyes.
Why, there's no need for you to go into town, Miss Sally. Whatever you need, I'll get it for you.
What if I told you I want to go to Amy's lady's shop to buy a new camisole? Would you buy that for me?
Well, I mean, if you told me what kind, I could...
See, you can't get whatever it is I might need. I have to do it myself.
I don't think you should be riding yet. It ain't been... I mean, it hasn't been that long since you got shot.
Nonsense. The wound is completely healed, and I feel fine. Smoke has been through this a dozen times. So have you and Pearlie. Besides, I'm getting cabin fever. I have to get out of this house.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I reckon I can understand that, all right. I can ride along with you.
Oh, for heaven's sake, Cal. Are you saying there isn't enough to keep you busy here at the ranch?
Well, yes, ma'am. I reckon there is. It's just
nothing. Don't worry about me. I will be all right. Nothing is going to happen.
Yes, ma'am. Well, I'll hitch up the buckboard, or would you rather take the surrey?
Neither. I'm going to ride. You can saddle my horse if you would like.
But don't you think it'd be better if, you know, you took the surrey so you didn't have to ride?
Whatever question Cal was going to ask was cut off by a direct stare from Sally.
Yes, ma'am. I'll get your horse saddled.
Cal, saddle the filly.
Yes, ma'am. I know you have a particular like for that horse.
As Sally rode into the town, she felt an exhilarating sense of freedom. For the first time since she had been shot, she felt like her old self, and in her enthusiasm, she urged her horse into a gallop. Leaning down over the horse's neck, she galloped at full speed for at least a quarter mile, enjoying the wind in her face and hair. Finally, she stopped the gallop and allowed the horse to continue at a gait needed to cool her down. She patted the horse's neck.
Good girl. Smoke won't race us because I think he's afraid you could beat Seven. I don't just think it, I know you could beat him. But between us girls, there's no need to be showing the men up right now, is there? Sometimes we just have to grin and bear it.
Jericho Taggart was sitting in the brown dirt cowboy, nursing a beer. He knew this was where Smoke lived. All he had to do was hang around town until he showed up.
Well, look there! That's Mrs. Jensen riding down the street just as sassy as you please. She sure don't look none the worse for being shot now, does she?
A couple others moved to the front to watch as Sally rode by.
That's Smoke Jensen's wife, isn't it?
Oh, yeah. Oh, you was asking about him, wasn't you? Well, sir, if you was to go and ask Mrs. Jensen, I'll bet she could tell you where he is and when he's getting home.
Taggart finished his beer, then walked to the livery stable where he rented two saddled horses, complete with saddles and gear. After that, he left town, going in the direction of Sugarloaf Ranch, riding one horse and leading the other. Sally was on her way back to the ranch, her purchase for the day in a bag hanging from the saddle horn. She was about halfway home. To her shock and horror, her horse's head seemed to explode in front of her as blood, bone, and brain matter burst out. The horse fell. It happened so fast, Sally was barely able to get her leg out from under her. In doing so, she was out of position, and her head hit the ground hard. Everything went black. Sally was aware that she was sitting in the saddle of a horse being led by another rider who was in front of her. Almost at the same moment, she realized that her hands were tied together and her ankles were tied to the stirrups. She was confused as to why and how she had gotten there. Then she remembered hearing a shot and seeing her horse's head explode in front of her. How long ago was that? She was able to lift her hands and found her watch, still pinned to the bodice of her dress. Pulling it out, she examined it. It was 5 minutes after 11. It was 10 o'clock when she left town to start back home, and it couldn't have been more than 15 minutes later when she was ambushed on the road. How long had she been on this horse? She couldn't remember a thing beyond her horse being shot, but she must have been conscious. Unless the man in front of her put her on the horse while she was unconscious. She had no memory of any of that.
Who are you? Where are we going?
The rider stopped, then looked back at her.
Oh, so you're not too high and mighty to talk to me now, are you? I've been trying to get you to say something for the last hour.
I don't remember anything about the last hour. Why am I tied up? What do you want with me?
Oh, I don't want you for anything. It's your husband I want.
What is your name?
My name is Taggart. Jericho Taggart.
Why do you want my husband, Mr. Taggart?
Because he's worth $5,000, dead or alive.
That's ridiculous. My husband isn't a wanted man. He's an outstanding, law-abiding citizen.
Someone wants him, and they're willing to pay $5,000 for him.
Well, if you want him, why have you taken me?
He'll be coming for you, won't he?
You better believe he will.
That's what I'm counting on.
Smoke was at the depot waiting for Seven to be offloaded from the stock car when Sheriff Carson saw him.
Smoke, welcome home.
Hello, Monty.
Smoke took the Deputy U.S. Marshal's badge from his pocket and handed it to the sheriff.
I won't be needing this anymore.
I take it your quest came out to your satisfaction?
Let's just say that Dinkins and his gang will rob no more banks and shoot no more women.
Oh, that reminds me, Sally's in town.
To see the doctor? Is something wrong?
No, didn't mean to cause you any worry. She's looking fine. She rode in herself. Told me she was doing a little shopping and never felt better.
Well, where is she now, do you know?
I don't have any idea, to be honest. Been a little over an hour since I saw her.
Good. I hope she's still in town. We can ride home together.
Mountain 7, Smoke rode up and down the main street looking for Sally's horse. When he didn't see it anywhere, he figured she must be riding home. 4 miles out of town, Smoke saw several buzzards circling. In order to attract that many buzzards, he knew there had to be something dead and bigger than a rabbit or even a coyote. He urged Seven into a gallop, and a moment later saw a horse down. It was Sally's horse. When he reached the horse, he jumped down from the saddle. Sally was nowhere to be seen, and his first thought was that she had walked on home. but the bag of her purchases was still attached to the saddle horn, and he knew she wouldn't have left them.
Oh my God, what happened to the horse?
The horse's head was laid open like a smashed watermelon. This was no accident. As Smoke examined the dirt road around the horse, he saw hoof prints coming from the side of the road to the horse, then going back to the side of the road from the horse. The footprints were made by a man's boot. He saw no sign of Sally. Following the direction of the footprints, Smoke saw the print of two horses, and he saw something else, the empty cartridge of a .50 caliber bullet. What happened to Sally's horse was no longer a mystery. Someone had waited until Sally came along and killed her horse. The fact that he didn't kill Sally meant she wasn't his principal target. Whoever it was after Smoke, and he was using Sally as bait.
All right, Mr. Bushwhacker. I'm going to take the bait, so you better be ready for me, because I'm damn sure ready for you.
Ahead of Smoke, the brown land lay in empty folds of rock, dirt, and sage. Smoke picked up the tracks of the two riders, but the ground was hard and the tracks so indistinct that he couldn't tell very much about them. He couldn't be sure Sally was one of the riders, but it was the best he had to go on. He saw a piece of green calico hanging on some sage, and he knew he was on the right track then. It also told him that she was all right.
Good girl, Sally.
15 minutes after he found the first bit of cloth, he found another. It not only told him he was still on the right trail, it saved his life. The second piece of cloth was lying on the ground, and he got off his horse to pick it up. Just as he was dismounting, a heavy ball whistled by, taking his hat off and fluffing his hair. The bullet hit a rock and knocked a huge chunk out of it. That had to be a .50 caliber bullet, meaning he had found the man he was looking for. Or the man had found him. If that bullet had hit him, it would have taken off the top of his head and he would have been as dead as Sally's horse. Moving quickly, Smoke slapped Seven's flank to get him out of the line of fire, then dived for a nearby rock just as a second shot whizzed by. Smoke wriggled his body under cover, then raised himself slowly to take a look around. He saw the crown of a hat poking over the top of a rock, so he aimed. The hat went sailing away.
You're pretty good with that little pea shooter, Jensen. But face it, you don't have a chance against my Sharps 50.
Who the hell are you?
The name is Taggart. Jericho Taggart. I reckon you've heard of me.
I reckon not. Sally with you?
Yeah, she's with me.
Sally! Sally, are you there?
She can't answer you, Jensen. I got a gag stuffed in her mouth.
Taggart, if you're after the $5,000 reward, maybe you should know there's no such thing. I'm not wanted. That's a poster Bill Dinkins put out.
Whether Dinkins pays the reward or the sheriff does makes no difference to me.
Dinkins can't pay the reward. He's dead.
You killed him, I suppose.
I killed him, his half-brother Wes Harley, and the two Slater brothers.
My, you have been a busy man, haven't you, Jensen?
Since that Dodger was put out by Dinkins and not by the sheriff of La Plata County, and Dinkins is dead, there's no money for you in killing me.
The bullet hit the rock right in front of Smoke and kicked pea-sized chunks of rock into his face, opening up wounds. The impact was so great that for a moment Smoke thought he'd been hit, but he knew that couldn't be right. If he'd actually been hit, he'd be dead. Smoke turned around and slid to the ground.
Ha! This 50 will chew up some rock, won't it?
What are you still shooting for? I told you there's no money in it.
Well, let's just say once it gets out that I'm the one who killed the famous Smoke Jensen, I'll find a way to turn it into money.
I want to hear Sally's voice.
Do you now?
Let me hear her say something.
Don't worry about her. After I kill you, I'll let her go.
Do you think killing me with that .50 caliber rifle from 50 yards away is gonna make you famous?
I don't know. Maybe you have a point. Folks do say you're as fast as grease lighting with that gun of yours. Is that right?
You wanna try me?
Do I wanna try you? Now that would be foolish now, wouldn't it? I like to do my killing with a Sharps 50. This isn't exactly the kind of gun you'd use in a fighting duel.
I see. Tell me, Taggart, have most of your kills been from half a mile away? Have you ever had the courage to face a man down? Look him in the eyes? At least Harley was man enough to do that.
That's the way it is.
That's the coward's way.
You can call me whatever you want, Mr. Jensen, but the truth is I got your woman, and the only way you're gonna get her back is to come through me.
Smoke raised up just a bit.
Oh, yeah. I should have told you. My 50 is a single shot, so just to keep me safe between shots, I also have a Winchester.
You have it all figured out, don't you, Taggart?
I have to. Killing folks is my profession.
You sound as if you're proud of that.
How about you? I'll bet if truth were known, you've killed more people than I have.
It's not something I take pride in.
Well, tell you what, Jensen. What do you say me and you meet each other out in the open? You with your pistol, me with my Winchester. You got the guts to try that?
What? Let me get this straight. You're offering to go up against me.
Yeah, I'm a sporting man. Step out now with your pistol in your holster. I'll step out with my Winchester and we'll go against each other. To make it more even, I'll toss my Sharps out on the ground.
Smoke looked around the rock and saw Taggart hold the big buffalo rifle up and then toss it.
There! See, I wasn't lying to you. There's my 50 lying on the ground. Come on out now.
Smoke hesitated.
Oh, I understand. You're afraid that if you come out, I'll shoot you, right? Just to make you feel better, I'll come out first.
Smoke raised up again to take a look and saw Taggart coming out from behind the rock. Then he saw Taggart reach back and pull Sally out from behind the rock. She was gagged and her wrists were bound together. Her ankles were tied together with a short piece of rope that would let her shuffle but not walk, and certainly wouldn't let her run.
All right, Mr. Jensen. As you can see, I'm already out here.
Smoke holstered his pistol, then stepped out from behind the rock.
Well, I'll be damned. I didn't really think you'd do it.
Well, I'm a surprising man, but I'm not a dumb man.
Taggart reached for Sally and pulled her over to stand in front of him.
Now let's see if you're good enough to hit me without hitting your wife. Interesting challenge, isn't it?
Smoke looked into Sally's eyes and saw not fear, but determination. She was trying to tell him something, but what? She blinked a couple of times and stared pointedly, and all of a sudden he realized what she was saying. Smoke smiled at her. She smiled back.
Anytime, Mr. Jensen.
Now!
Sally threw herself to the ground. Her sudden and unexpected move not only exposed Taggart, it surprised him into a split second of indecision. And that split second was all Smoke Jensen needed. Smoke saw Sally trying to get back up and hurried over to her. He lifted her up, then removed the gag. Not only had Taggart bound a cloth around her mouth, but he had also stuck a sock in it. She reached up with her bound wrists and pulled the sock out.
Oh, that was awful. I don't think that sock has ever been washed.
If you'll stop spitting, I'll kiss you.
You'll taste sock.
No, I'll taste only you.
Oh.
They kissed. Then Sally held up her hands.
Untie my wrists. I can't kiss properly with my hands tied.
Smoke untied her hands.
So what makes you think you need your hands to kiss?
So I can do this.
She leaned into him, put her arms around him and her hands on the back of his head to pull him closer. They kissed deeply. Then all of a sudden, Sally stiffened and pulled away from him. Smoke looked at her in surprise, but before he could say anything, she pulled his pistol from his holster. He whirled around then and saw that Taggart had sat up and cocked his Winchester. Sally stood there, holding the pistol in her hand, staring down at Taggart's body. She continued to stare as Smoke got down on his knees long enough to untie the rope that had her ankles bound together. Then he stood up and took his pistol from her hand.
What do you say we go home?
What about him?
Leave him for the critters.
Smoke Jensen, the Mountain Man number 39, Assault of the Mountain Man, is a graphic audio production. Copyright 2012, William W. Johnstone. Published by arrangement with Kensington Publishing Corporation. All rights reserved. Production copyright 2012, The Cutting Corporation. All rights reserved. Performed by James Lewis, Drew Kopis, Elizabeth Jernigan, Tim Carlin, Johann Detweiler, Richard Rowan, Christopher Sheeran, Terence Aselford, Michael Glenn, Patrick Bussink, Stephen Carpenter, David Coyne, Dan Sontag, Nick DePinto, Thomas Keegan, MJ Casey, Yasmin Twazon, Kimberly Gilbert, Alyssa Wilmoth, Thomas Penny, Eric Messner, Ken Jackson, Scott McCormick, Christopher Graybill, Joe Brack, and Evan Casey. Directed by Johann Detweiler. Produced by Rick Rowan and Dwayne Beeman. Executive producers James Cutting, Mary Cutting, and Angie Cornett. Dialogue editing, graphic audio sound design, and Smoke Jensen theme music by Johann Detweiler. Book adapted for graphic audio by Johann Detweiler. If you enjoyed Assault of the Mountain Man, read the Pinnacle Edition. Visit www.kensingtonbooks.com and be sure to look for William W. Johnstone's The First Mountain Man, The Last Mountain Man, Blood Bond, The Last Gunfighter, Eagles and Sidewinder series, as well as Elmer Kelton's Texas Ranger series. All available in graphic audio at Road Stops Everywhere, at 1-800-670-5220, or at www.graphicaudio.net, where you'll find samples of all our Action Pump titles, as well as free downloads and podcasts. Now, keep listening for exciting previews of other titles in graphic audio.
The warded man stalks the night, slaying demons with the newly discovered wards of power. But now, a new threat is rising. An old friend, now a bitter enemy. And he has in his possession a weapon that could unite all humanity or tear it to pieces. The Desert Spear. Witness the rise of Amon Jardir in the Demon Cycle, Book 2, The Desert Spear. Available now in graphic audio.
Now we can invade the Greenlands.
The Samhasts have been driven to the brink of extinction. But from the depths of a primeval source of power, a new threat is rising. The last stand of the Samhasts will bring the land of Haunts to the brink of destruction. And this time, even the Highwayman may not be able to save the world from the darkness of the Ancient. Don't miss the thrilling continuation of the Saga of the First King in R.A. Salvatore's The Ancient. Available now in graphic audio.
If you can't find that graphic audio title you're looking for, go to www.graphicaudio.net, where you can order it in CD format or digital download. If you're on the road, call 1-800-670-5220. That's 1-800-670-5220. or www.graphicaudio.net. And if you're looking for a great way to try out a different Graphic Audio series, check out our convenient and easy-to-store long-haul box sets, which contain up to 5 books of a series. Available only at www.graphicaudio.net. Be sure to sign up for our monthly newsletter or follow us on Twitter.